There are giants among us, passing largely unnoticed, intent on carrying out a secret plan to enslave all humanity. They may not look like giants today, but their bloodlines extend all the way back to the Nephilim, the offspring of angels who mated with human women, described in Genesis 6, when giants roamed the land. This Genesis 6 conspiracy marches toward the Great Tribulation, when the loyalty of the terminal generation, this generation, will be tested. The Bible, along with many other ancient sources, clearly records the existence of giants. When God cast the angel Lucifer and his followers out of heaven, Lucifer set into motion a scheme to ensure the Nephilim survived. Why would he do that? Well, because from the bloodlines of these Nephilim, the Antichrist will come. To keep his plan alive, Satan has enlisted the loyalty of secret societies such as the Freemasons, the Templars, the Rosicrucians, to consider and to conspire in teaching a theology and a history of the world that is contrary to the biblical one. Stay tuned for my interview with Gary Wayne, author of The Genesis 6 Conspiracy, How Secret Societies and the Descendants of Giants Plan to Enslave Humanity, next on the Soaring Eagle Radio.
Remember that your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko.
The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of other things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings.
My mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Welcome to Soaring Eagle Radio. Your host is Mike Spaulding. Get ready to be challenged and encouraged as you consider today's news and Mike's commentary from a biblical perspective. Now, let's join Mike.
Welcome, friends. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Soaring Eagle Radio. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes or Stitcher or TuneIn. And we would appreciate you leaving a rating. You can listen to every episode, of course, from our website, SoaringEagleRadio.com, and you can follow us on Facebook. My guest today on this episode is Gary Wayne. He has maintained a lifelong love affair with biblical prophecy, history, and mythology. His extensive study has encompassed the Bible and Gnostic scriptures, the Quran, Gilgamesh and other ancient epics, language, etymology, and secret society publications. I've been looking forward to this conversation for a long time. Welcome to the Soaring Eagle Radio Show, Gary.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be here tonight, and I'm hoping that the conversation that we're going to have is going to be of interest to the audience and maybe perhaps stir some curiosity into some areas that maybe they haven't looked at as closely as I think that people should look at it, and maybe start them on a, you know, sort of a new sort of pathway to answering some of the interesting and unanswered questions of history.
Yes, I think that's a good way to state it, Gary. It'll encourage people in their own research. I know, having read the book, that has certainly done that for me, and I will say that I'm very impressed with the amount of research, the footnotes, the sources, the bibliography that you give, all of the resources that you pulled in to writing this book. You've spent an enormous amount of time researching the subject matter that ultimately led to the writing of the Genesis 6 conspiracy. Genesis is one of the most interesting as well as important books in the Bible. In fact, it may be arguably the most important book. Unlocking the meaning behind the Genesis narrative really unlocks the rest of Scripture. So by way of introduction to who you are, Gary, would you share with our listeners what inspired you to tackle what is in most Christian circles a taboo subject, the Genesis 6 account?
Yeah, so I'm a history buff and I'm a mythology buff, and I'm also a prophecy buff. And so I really didn't think, you know, that I was going to spend so much time on the research of this, because my more passion is into a prophecy. But I decided what I would do. I wanted to connect Genesis 6 to Revelations, because I agree with what you were saying on your comments, that I really look at Genesis almost as the Rosetta Stone, if I can use it in that sort of analogy, to understanding what's going on in the rest of the Bible.
Yeah.
And also, I think I write in my book that, you know, I start in Genesis and I'm going to return to Genesis. And that's how much importance I place on Genesis. So I thought I was going to write my shortest book first to cut my teeth on, because I have all these other prophecy books that I'm intending on writing, but I thought this was going to be a short book, and it probably turned out to be the longest book I'll ever write, because it is a very extensive book. And I wanted to do a few things. I wanted to connect what these strange beings being talked about in Genesis 6 were to these beings that are talked about still in Genesis in the time of Abraham and in the time of the Exodus afterwards, and in the time of, you know, Israel on the conquest, to what Jesus was talking about in the Gospels, and where the times, the end times and his second coming would be very similar to the days of Noah. And so connecting both before and after the flood, because Noah lived both before and after, why Jesus would say that is a key thing we need to understand the end times. And also connecting the mysterious sort of other things that the Bible talks about, particularly in the New Testament, about demons in the time of Jesus and how many demons he was dealing with, the Satan, Lucifer aspect of and fallen angels, what happens with the abyss in the end times, the demons that lead the world leaders and armies to Armageddon, and all the powers of Lucifer being brought to the Antichrist and the false prophets in the end days. So I wanted to connect that in one narrative, because I felt there was one narrative there, and I think that's really what the Bible is doing for believers, is talking about that one narrative, although there's a lot of other aspects, because it's a very nuanced, complicated book. But I wanted to connect that. I wanted to bring a sense of credibility to the giant Nephilim supernatural phenomena. So I wanted to give different perspectives, what secret societies might be talking about, what other religions might be talking about, and line that up with what the Bible says, and let those other adversaries speak for themselves as to what they believe happened, what they're doing, and what they're planning to do, and create not just one narrative, but almost through the bibliography, a reference book for people that they can go check my work on, and take a lot of the speculation out, and have people check my sources to understand that what I'm presenting is accurate, and it's in their own words. Because I do an incredible, I think, mixture of Bible and other sources, but also so the listener understands, because I'm presuming we have a mainly Christian audience here,
yes,
is that everything I write about is measured against what it says in the Bible first.
Mm-hmm.
And so I use those other sources for context to help tell the story.
Yes.
But everything is based on what the Bible says. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of the intent of the book. And then hopefully through that is maybe show people things in the Bible that they hadn't thought about, and start them on a quest of maybe awakening to all these things that are going on in plain sight that most people don't recognize.
Yes, yes. And I wholeheartedly agree with your analysis of the book connecting the dots. This book really is, Gary, for me, and I have talked to other people about it since I've been reading it. It really is a researcher's dream for me. You've got 98 chapters. You have 803 pages, which includes the end notes to each chapter, a complete, very thorough presentation of the information. And folks, just for our listeners, Gary starts section one, the antediluvian epic, and he concludes with section eight, the gene of Isis. Now, between those chapters, he covers everything there is to cover, follows every, and I don't mean this in a bad way, covers every rabbit trail there is to cover, that you could every stone that you could possibly unturn in trying to explain what we're reading in the scriptures. So that leads us then to this. The thought occurred to me, Gary, as I'm reading this, that this could be, for those who might get a hold of this as an introductory book, in other words, their first reading about the Genesis 6 Nephilim, this could really be an earth-shaking book for them. And the reason for that is, when looking at prophecy, many Christians look to the Old Testament, and then from there they follow their own theology to explain and in some cases even reject what they might think is impossible. So they get in what I call a theological rut, and they're not able to escape that because they're not able to accept the fact that perhaps the Bible is saying something different than what you were taught. And perhaps a better way to approach prophecy would be to understand what Jesus said, and to let the chips fall where they may. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that is, I couldn't describe better one of my first pillars of studying scripture or prophecy. My first inclination, I guess it's stronger than an inclination. I don't think I need to be quite as polite about that aspect. I think it's my first principle of the Bible is I look to what Jesus said first. And then
yes.
I assemble everything else around what he said, and not vice versa.
Yes.
Because, and then the other thing I try and do is I try and assemble all the passages and everything related to that doctrine or prophecy or idea so that you see all of perhaps nuances or all the different information about it. Otherwise, I think you get too caught up in, just as you said, a preconceived
yes.
idea, and then try and make everything fit around that. And what I've tried to do is let the Bible read for itself.
Yes.
And I don't have to like it, and I have to admit, just as you were alluding to earlier, that I found many of the things as I was going through shocking, disturbing,
yes.
Confusing, but that just sort of, for me, it just lit a more of enthusiasm, that lit that sort of fuse to get to the bottom of what was going on. And
yes.
So I use that in a positive way as saying, I'm confused and I don't know where this is going. And so what I did with all of prophecy and with anything that has to do with giants or anything related to giants, he says, I logged the Bible. And I went through several times to make sure I had every passage filed with each related verse and passage, so that I can go back as a reference and say, okay, what's everything being said about this? Now, not every aspect of the Bible did I do it, but the ones I was interested in, prophecy and some major doctrines.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. So, understanding an accurate history of the Bible, as you've just stated, it really helps us to understand the mythologies that are out there all across the world. Now, I bring that up, Gary, because so many times in my interactions with unbelievers, They're quick to throw out a mythological story that they suppose predates the biblical record and use that as an example of why the Bible is wrong. And I think just the opposite is true. I think if we take the Bible at face value and what it's actually saying and take the blinders of preconception off, then we'll see that the mythologies that we find really all across the world, and I'll use the flood narrative as an example, and I'm going to throw this back to you now. The various flood narratives across the world really support the truthfulness of the scriptures, and it doesn't invalidate the scripture at all, does it?
No, it doesn't. I think it actually enhances what it says about the flood and other aspects of prehistory and after the flood in the Bible. And I think, you know, the first thing that someone needs to take a step back when they're looking at different mythologies is two aspects. Is they've been called mythologies, but if you talk to the Greeks or if you talk to North American natives, that's their history. And
yes,
it's also a history with their religion. So if we take that not totally at face value, but understand that they have a little bit different perspective than it just being mythology, and then we analyze what they're talking about, let's say about the flood, for example, all we need to do to understand what they're talking about is that they have a different perspective than monotheists do.
Yes.
Or people who believe in the Bible.
Yes.
And so they are describing the same events, but from a polytheist or pagan perspective.
Yes.
And so they'll describe it a little bit differently and make maybe invert the good and the bad guys or the good God and the bad God type of thing. But at the end of the day, they're telling the same story. And people may not be aware of it, but the flood is one of those common global world legacies, histories or heritages that is inexplicable because it is on all inhabited continents within mythology and or scripture. And it is in more than 500 cultures, and all of them talk about the Great Flood. And no one can account for how that sort of memory can exist except that they're talking about the same event.
Yes.
And connected within that sort of history and legacy is they're telling the same story as to how the flood came about. It's just from a different perspective, whether or not it's God's mating with human females to create other beings that aren't called Nephilim in their mythology or religion. They could be called Anunnaki in the Sumerian religion. They could be called Titans in the Greek religion. They're known by so many different names around the world, but nonetheless they are demigods and nonetheless they are giants.
Yes.
And so they talk about this creation and how they started off, and of course in a polytheist perspective, they generally start off as good and judicious rulers that slowly slide into decay and debauchery and turn the world into an evil place, and thus comes the flood to wipe those civilizations out.
Yes.
And so it's almost an identical story to the Nephilim account in Genesis 6, except it's from a polytheist perspective. Now you layer in that all of these stories talk about giants on all these different cultures and more. All of these accounts talk about people surviving the flood. All of these religions and mythologies include pyramid building, and they include a pantheon of gods, and they include little people, and so much more that is commonality. I could not discount that they were telling the same story, because
yes,
it starts the same and it ends the same, and so many of the details are the same. They just give us more context as how I look at it, and then I weigh everything against what they say and says, okay, now how does that fit with what the Bible says?
Yes, yeah. I'm going to put a bookmarker or a marker here on where we are at. It just occurred to me, Gary, that perhaps I've gotten a little bit ahead of myself because I assumed something from the beginning. And that is that my listeners understand exactly what the Genesis 6 controversy even is. So,
yeah, they may not.
And they may not. So maybe we should go back and let's chat about Genesis chapter 6, especially those first four verses, and then take it from there. When you're talking about giants, how in the world did that come about?
Well, when we talk about giants, we're talking about the description in Genesis 6 about the sons of God, and in the original Hebrews, that is Ben Ha'aloim, the sons of God went to the daughters of men to produce and had sex with them to produce the Nephilim. And the Nephilim were known as heroes of old and men of renown, and depending on which translation that you're using, but they were definitely men of renown in the ancient world. And also the Greeks would call them heroes and men of renown in epics like Homer, which, again, I don't find to be a coincidence. So
Yes. These
were supernatural beings, and they were demigods. And if we take the word hero and we take that back to the ancient meaning, not what we look at hero today as somebody who just does something good, but hero in the ancient world was understood as a demigod and as two-thirds god and one-third human from the cohabitation of a god with a human female to produce a Nephilim or a Titan or Anunnaki or whatever name you want to use for these particular giants. And so these were supernatural beings because they had the immortal spirit of the fallen angels put into a human. So you have the spirit of heaven mixing with the flesh of the physical world. Mm-hmm. And that was a violation against creation, but the consequence of that was is they had an immortal spirit and they were demigods.
Mm-hmm.
And now their spirit could not die, but their bodies could die.
Yes.
And God also steps in Genesis 6 as well, and after this violation against creation and limits the life forms to 120 years, which takes several generations to fully work its way down, but at the end we don't see people or giants living past 120 years old. But the original ones were immortal, and those are the demons that Jesus talks about, because these were the reprobate spirits, as Enoch, and I know that's not canon, but as Enoch describes them as reprobate spirits, that were not permitted into heaven, and they were not permitted to go to sleep. And so these are the demons that roam, and so they are different than the fallen angels or the sons of God that went to the daughters of human beings. And so how do we know, and one of the big question is, how do we know the sons of God were actually angels as opposed to Sethites or just regular humans,
right,
which generally is taught in Sunday school or
in right.
most churches, because most people don't want to deal with this sort of supernatural idea.
That's right. That's exactly what it is. Yeah. The implications of that's a little bit overwhelming.
And I can understand that.
Sure.
But if we go to, let's say, Job, and we go to Job 1:6 or 2:1 mm-hmm. or 38:4, I think through 7, or it might just be in 4.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, depending on which translation you're using, and I use several, but angels are recorded there as presenting themselves to God. These angels is the translation from Hebrew from the sons of God.
Yes.
So right there, from our understanding in modern language, what angels are, and three times in Job it says they are the sons of God. And
yes.
So the Ben Ha'aloim in Genesis 6 are the sons of God. So we take that from Job that is actually angels. And if we extend out of how from the idea that it's humans mating with humans, there's no way we're going to get a demigod or a supernatural being
mm-hmm.
or a giant. That just can't happen without some other sort of intercession.
Yes.
And most of the idea where people will argue away that, to keep the sort of debate short here, why some people will say that they are humans that mated with humans, is to say, well, sons of God are used in other parts of the Bible. And that's true.
That's true.
But typically what they're arguing from is the event of the Pentecost. And at the Pentecost, we are adopted as the sons of God in this whole process as joint heirs with Jesus. And this is an adoption process. This is not a literal physical process. And if we look at other verses that talk about the sons of God in the New Testament and talking about what's being talked about being adopted into the new covenant, it's exactly what it says, whether it's in Acts 2, where it says, you know, sons of God adoption as joint heirs, again, into the new covenant, or in Galatians, adopted as joint heirs with Jesus, and it says this several times, but there's one real key one, other than the fact that you can say it's still the same term. If we go to Hebrews 12:7, it says that God treats us as sons, even though we have human fathers. And so when we're looking at this adoption process, it is a New Testament covenant that is being talked about, and we're being adopted because our Redeemer died for us, and we are now joint heirs with him for the future world. And I think when you look at all of those, every one of those verses in the New Testament will talk about this as an adoption process. So just as a quick sort of short argument, and then other aspects is that people might say, but in Matthew it talks about there is no marriage in heaven. So therefore, how can angels have sex?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep, I've
and
heard that.
And that they don't have a sexual gender. But we have to remember, though, that angels are a different being, and when they come to this realm, they actually take on a different, let's call it a set of clothes. And as they put on these physical clothes and are affected by the physical world, they have the ability to take a gender, and a gender of their choosing.
Mm-hmm.
And so this can account for how they would be able to have sex with human females and actually be able to produce an offspring, because when we look at Genesis 6, this is actually what happens, and now we have a process for how this happens. And it's also an answer for how the lower pantheon is created with lower levels of gods, because in, this is my speculation, and I'll come back to supporting what I was saying about these different set of clothes in a second, is in the other religions, they have these lower level of gods that are not nearly as powerful, and they're produced from other gods.
Yes.
Right? So, yeah. Now let's take that back to the Bible. How do we know that? So if we look at Jude 1:6, and this talks about in Jude 1:6 about the sins and the violations, the sexual violations, that the angels did in the time of Noah, and they left their habitation. They left their positions of authority to go do this, to copulate with human females. But if we go back to the Greek word for habitation, it's an interesting word called oikotarion. And we only see that word used one other place in the New Testament, and that's in 2 Corinthians. And this word oikotarion refers to this clothing that you put on when you go to heaven, and you put on and take off this particular clothing. So when we look at a scriptural answer for how they change form, there's a physical clothes that they put on when they come here. That's 2 Corinthians 5 if you want to go read it and check it out, and Jude 1:6 if somebody wants to look at it.
Yeah.
And if you go to Strong's and look at the words being used there for the clothing, it'll take it back to oikotarion. So it's used for a specific application only. And the definition of oikotarion is it's a dwelling place or a body for the spirit, or the clothes for the spirit.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
And it's a different set of clothes than the physical one. So you have a spiritual one and you have a physical one. And this is important to understand because when we see other references to angels in the Bible, they're different.
Yeah.
So if we look at, let's say, Satan, he has a seraphic form where he appears as a serpent and he and a dragon, and he also is a cherubim. So if that's the case, then he obviously has a changeling quality. If we see an angel, the three angels that visited Abraham at the time of Sodom and Gomorrah, they come off as human beings, just as they do in other aspects of the Bible. But yet in Daniel, we get a completely different description of this glorious-looking angel and a being of light, which is a significant understanding of angels that I get into in the book. So without sort of litigating the whole case, hopefully, and if somebody wants to get a hold of me, they can get a hold of me, and I'll answer more specifically with more information or read my book because I'll have most of this information in the book. But so we have a case where they have the ability to take different shapes. We have an understanding of how that works from the Bible, and we have an example in the Bible of them in different forms. And so if we go back to the idea that marriage doesn't take place in heaven and sex doesn't take place in heaven, that doesn't discount the fact that it can't take place in the physical world. And if you go back to what I said and what the Book of Enoch will say, that was a violation against creation. So even though it is a possibility and likely did happen, and I believe did happen, it should not have happened and was not permitted, but it is all part of sort of the angelic rebellion and the revenge against humankind, which I will also cover off in the book.
Yes, yes. And so these angels from Jude verse 6, who didn't keep their own domain but abandoned their proper abode, those are referred to elsewhere as the watchers.
Yes, that is correct. And as the watchers, I would also say that people might be familiar with them known as the Grigori, which is one of the translations and is a Greek translation.
Mm-hmm.
And also, they were seraphim angels.
Now, these women, Gary...
Just to finish off so people don't get confused here... Yeah. Is the Watchers and the Grigori were a specific order and rank of the seraphim angels.
Now that's going to be important later in this conversation, I believe, because of who Lucifer was, and you already mentioned part of that. I want to bring up the fact that the daughters of men that the Watchers cohabitated with were often led to believe. At least by those who will even discuss this, we're often led to believe that they were taken captive against their will, but there's an argument to be made that perhaps these daughters of men were actually daughters of Cain. They may have been predisposed to wickedness. Is that a viable statement, Gary?
I believe that largely, at least for the first 200, and the first violation against creation is that they were attracted to these beings of light, and they were predisposed, just as you said, to wanting to participate in this, because I'll make the case in the book that Cain, when he leaves Eden, or is ostracized from Eden, he begins his own lineage, and I actually think he marries into the people of day six. And I know that's very, very controversial, but I am a contrarian, and if somebody wants a 3 or 4 page document on how I arrive at that, I'll send that to them because it's quite detailed in terms of the differences between the day six account and the Eden account, which is how I arrive at Cain marrying into and taking a wife into these other people.
Yes,
and it's all biblical is what I'll give you. So.
Yes, what's the best way to send a request for that information, Gary?
You can get a hold of me on Facebook at my Gary Wayne page, or send me a message, Gary Wayne, or one of my Genesis 6 conspiracy pages. You can get a hold of me through Twitter on at Gary Wayne 63. @GaryWayne63, or you can email me through my website, which is www.genesis6conspiracy.com, and you can also get a hold of me at GaryWayne@Shaw.ca. Either way, I will get back to you, and I'll get back to you fairly quickly on it.
Okay, excellent. So you write that there are six generations. There were six generations before the giants appeared.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
yes, in the generation of Jared, this occurs.
Yes. Yes. Now, the watchers and the daughters of men produced the Nephilim. And the Nephilim were what you described earlier as demigods. And they became the heroes of old, the men of renown, the mythologies that surrounded the biblical history became the mythologies across the world. Is that a fair statement? And so the Nephilim, they had access to what you call the secret sciences, the secret knowledge, and they used that obviously to their advantage, but mankind became privy to some of that too, didn't they?
Yeah. So when we look at Genesis 6 and the Genesis 6 conspiracy, we need to understand that there's more going on than just the creation of the giants. So the giants and their descendants, they partner with the descendants of Cain, and it's the descendants of Cain through Cain and Enoch, first son of Cain, as opposed to Enoch, son of Jared, because there's two Enochs. And there's actually, if you go down both lineages of Cain and Seth, there's very similar names in how you pronounce them, and identical names in some cases. So it's
yes.
very important to keep straight
right.
the two different lineages as to who I'm talking about.
Yes.
Cain and Enoch are, well, let me take a step back. In the Garden of Eden, this comes out of secret society writings, just so people understand, and I'll bring it back to the Bible. And Freemasonry in particular, and what people may not understand is Freemasonry takes the formation of their secret societies back to this same time frame. And
yes.
it's all part of what is going on in prehistory, which we only get
yes.
a small glimpse of
yeah.
in Genesis. So according to the Freemasons, and we do know from the Bible that Adam is taught a lot of things by God in Eden. In the secret societies and in polytheist religions, they refer this to as the seven sacred sciences. And after Adam leaves Eden, he teaches these seven sacred sciences to Cain and to Abel. And then after Abel dies, Cain is ostracized, and then Adam teaches them to Seth. So we have two different kinds of applications that are going to be done with these seven sacred sciences as taught by Adam. The good application, which is done by the Sethites, and the bad application by Cain, and then the evil Enoch, as I'll call him in the book, and what he does to create it. And so the first thing they start to do with these sciences is they start to, in their rebellion against God, discredit God for everything and dismiss him, and
yes.
not give God the honor or the respect of the creator of everything in the universe. Which, again, is what we see happens in other religions and in science. Nobody wants to recognize God or the author of our creation. That's part of this religious and sacred sciences belief system.
That's the foundation as well of Gnosticism, isn't it, Gary?
It is. This is the foundation of Gnosticism.
Yes. Sounded like
it. It is, absolutely, because they start to create this knowledge cult, or gnosis.
Yes.
And, of course, the Gnostics will call the tree of good and evil that Adam and Eve ate of as the tree of gnosis.
Okay? Yes, yes.
So understand that everybody is taking their core belief systems back to the same time periods and the same events.
Mm.
Okay? And so These sciences are developed not to honor the God of the universe, but to honor the person who they have taken up as their God, which is Satan,
yes.
which is the one who deceived them in Eden.
Yes.
And so now they're going to develop these sciences to corrupt the world, and they're going to develop these sciences to honor and worship their new God and the newly created for human beings pantheon of gods.
Wow.
And these are the fallen angels. These
yes.
are the watchers.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so the fifth science is called geometry. And geometry is known within the craft. And if people don't understand what I mean by craft, I'm talking about the secret societies and the old Masonic lodges.
Yes.
And so the craft, as they call themselves, they will call the fifth science masonry.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of these ancient pyramids, these ancient megaliths, these ancient structures weren't created to honor the God of the universe. They were created to honor the pantheon and the fallen angels. And there's basically two belief systems other than atheism, which I still think is part of polytheism when you get down to it. But that's a different rabbit trail. You have polytheism and you have monotheism.
Yes.
And so if we understand that, then things become very, very simple as we try and understand prehistory.
Mm-hmm.
And so they not only do they develop all of these different megaliths that we can't do today, and they encoded them with sacred geometry and with astrological and astronomical codes and pinpointing and alignments that, again, was way beyond their ability to do it if we accept that these were just nomads and hunters and gatherers.
Right.
But in their mythology and their understanding, they were taught all of this by the gods. So that's where this starts to come back together again. And they developed these sciences to such a great level that they corrupted the whole world, and to a level that they believe was greater than what we have today. And when we look at what they did in terms of housing this knowledge and in the application of it, two things. One is we can look at some applications like the corruption of, let's say, as what we see going on today with plants and stuff, with the genome and DNA manipulation going on in plants and in animals. They totally corrupted the antediluvian world, not just with violence, which they did. They totally corrupted the world that there was very, very few pure creations of God that were left.
Mm-hmm.
When the Bible talks about corruption, this is the corruption and the application of the sciences, which is very similar to what we're seeing going on today, which is why Jesus warned us of it.
Yes.
The second thing that we need to understand what they did with this knowledge is they created first the mystical religion. And Enoch, son of Cain, is the one who is accredited by secret societies for inventing mysticism and sun worship and initiation and this whole process that has developed into all these other pagan religions around the world. And along with it, to specifically develop the knowledge, they developed the secret societies, and to keep it secret from the mundane people, or in what they would call the unennobled or the poor or the purebred humans. And they continue to do that today. So that's the need for the religion, and you always find the secret societies and the religions closely tied together. And it's no secret then, even you understand that if a Freemason, you understand him, if he's an adept, he's going to be a Gnostic, with what we talked about Gnosticism just a few minutes ago. This is an ancient religion that they carry forward into the present.
Yes, and they, as you mentioned, they trace their lineage, their ancestry, and the beginning of their knowledge or craft all the way back to certainly Enoch, but even Cain in some instances.
Yes, Cain is one of their obviously greatest patriarchs within the secret societies, as is Enoch. And as well as Lamech and Lamech's sons and daughters who developed some of these sciences. And, you know, in the Bible, we don't hear a whole bunch about Lamech's sons and daughters. This is, again, is Lamech of the Cain line, not Lamech who was the grandfather of Noah. So just so people understand who I'm talking about here.
Yes, yes.
You know, in the Bible we understand, you know, Tubal Cain as, you know, forging some tools and bronze and iron, which of course we're also told iron didn't exist, but I'll cover that off in the books as well. But that's another rabbit trail. And
Tubal
is a little bit about music, and we get a little bit about tents and ranching or farming or with Tubal.
Yeah.
But in craft mythology, Tubal Cain is a smith and an artificer, but an artificer of the greatest level, a grand master artificer. So he takes metallurgy to a whole new level. And Nama is known for weaving, which doesn't sound all that novice, but she's also known for marrying giants. And of course, Tubal is noted for music, but not music as what people would just know music as. There's two portions to music. One is that music is very pleasant and can be used to sort of put people's minds at ease and use evil in that way, but also it's mixed in with what people would know in the Pythagorean mysticism as number mysticism, because you have to have number mysticism in music to work, and so they're related. And then Jabal was developing masonry, which is the fifth science of the secret societies. And again, you don't see that in the Bible, but that's what the Freemasons are telling you.
Yes. Well, now you have you have a very interesting idea about how this knowledge spanned the flood. How did it survive the flood?
Well, the knowledge and the giants, also and the descendants of giants, somehow spanned the flood.
Yes.
Right? And so it's a twofold mystery, but let me deal with your question first.
Okay.
And we can go back if you like on that, because that's also a very big subject.
It is.
So in most people will be aware of the Tower of Babel. And what's interesting in the Tower of Babel is this happens very shortly after the flood. You know, within basically they start building the flood within, or the city of Babel and the tower within 70 years, and then they're going to spend another 50 years or so in the building of the city and the tower before God comes along and confuses the languages. Okay, so what's going on here is something that is very, very important. And Nimrod, and the account of Nimrod is closely associated with Babel in the Bible, but not directly connected. But we have this odd remark that comes along in Babel where, acting as one language, as one people, and together there's nothing that's going to be, you know, paraphrasing what they can do, preventing them to what they can do.
Right.
This is an echo of, because you get no sense of, I mean, they just came off the flood. What do they know? What technology do they have? How did they learn how to build this city and this tower so quickly?
Yeah.
This is an echo of the seven sacred sciences and the power and how fast it was being developed. So I'll make a case in the book through several chapters that Nimrod, and most Christians will accept this, was he had the stride like a giant, and he's described like a giant, as a Gibram, as a hero of old. I don't believe he was Nephilim, because he has direct descendancy back to Noah, and we have his genealogy in the Table of Nations, and all of the giants that are listed in the Old Testament, do not have a genealogy that goes back to Noah, or the Table of Nations in First Chronicles or Genesis.
Yes.
But he obviously is taking on the beliefs of the giants. And so he's setting up a giant or Nephilim-like civilization. And what happens, and according to other accounts that aren't in the Bible, and particularly in the Masonic legends of the craft, which holds their history, which is their Polychronicon, a fellow by the name of Hermes, which again everybody has heard of, through the occultic aspect of these religions, discovers two pillars that were made by Lamech's children. And on these two pillars are the listing of the seven sacred sciences and as much information that they could put on it. And one other one is the location of the knowledge of this of the seven sacred sciences that were stored, according to craft legends, in nine vaults by Enoch the Evil, or the records of Enoch the Evil, but by Lamech's children, in nine vaults stacked on top of each other underneath the pyramids in Egypt. And so Hermes partners with Nimrod with this newly discovered knowledge, starts to build Babel, starts the rebellion again, and Nimrod is considered an antichrist-type figure and role model and somebody we should look for what's going to happen in the end time for the antichrist, because he has universal sway. And they're developing this knowledge at such a fast pace. And God comes along and says, no, I'm not going to permit this to happen. And what's interesting about this tower is, tower, pyramid, and ziggurat are known as the same type of structure in the ancient world. And in other accounts, it wasn't a tower, it was actually a ziggurat or a pyramid. And even the Aztecs and the Chula and other Central American mythologies have, and religions have, accounts that are very, very similar to the Tower of Babel. And also Mesopotamian records called it a ziggurat that he was building. And so he was trying to build a pyramid because this is where the seraphim angels went down to Mount Hermon to start the first generation of Nephilim back before the flood. And he's likely trying to bring back fallen angels, maybe ones that did not have sexual copulation and were not imprisoned into the abyss for that creation at the time of the flood, to come back and create new giants for a possible second incursion. So when the average person understands Babel and the name, Babel is this confusion of languages as it's translated out of Hebrew. It makes perfect sense. But the civilization that Nimrod starts after Babel is the Akkadian civilization.
Mm-hmm.
And in Akkadian, Babel translates as babe as gate or gateway, and El as God.
So what you're saying, Gary, is Nimrod was attempting the same rebellion that resulted in the flood in the first place.
Yes, within 100 years of the flood.
Wow.
And Hermes then, after the dispersion of what's going on at Babel, Nimrod goes and continues developing the seven sacred sciences in Chaldea. I should have said they were Chaldean and then the Akkadian Empire after that to get the history correct. But that's where the Magi come from, right? That's the priesthood out of the seven sacred sciences, or any of these wizards that you see in modern day recantations of prehistory, whether it's Lord of the Rings or King Arthur or after the flood. Anytime you see wizards, that's the priesthood of mysticism in the encoded language that they're putting in for their history and all of these fairy tales and things. And Hermes goes to Egypt. Why? Because he was there to get the knowledge, and starts the Egyptian religion afterwards. And again, that's why Freemasonry bases most of their symbolism on the ancient religion of Egypt.
Wow.
Because of Hermes and how important he is going forward. Mm-hmm. And that's where you have those two bases of this antediluvian religion crossing the flood and the knowledge crossing the flood and being developed afterwards, and then it's spread to the rest of the world.
Yes. Yes. Wow. So that brings us then to really that answers the other question. How did this knowledge span the flood? Because it was hidden, it was secreted away. So that brings us to how did the giants survive the flood?
Again, absolutely. Then there's three ways for that. And I'll just finish off a couple other things on the knowledge surviving the flood. So
sure.
In other records, other recantations of what happened before the flood, and particularly in Gnostic Gospels and some of the various books of Enoch, which are definitely Gnostic for sure, there's a warning that comes to the various peoples around the world, and they're warned that the flood is coming. And so they're going to preserve their knowledge, and they're going to preserve monuments memorializing how great their society became. because they actually had developed a science in their own mythos that could destroy the world. It was that powerful.
Wow.
And that's another reason why they wanted to keep it within these mystery schools.
Yes.
So the same thing happens with the giants in one of the ways on how they survive. So there's only three ways giants can survive the flood. One is that there is a recursion after the flood, which possibly happened at Babel, or at Sodom and Gomorrah, which I'll cover off in the book. The second possible way is that, because not all the seraphim angels were imprisoned in the abyss, only the ones who had sexual violations were imprisoned. So there's other fallen angels in the angelic rebellion that are still moving around out there. Second way of giants surviving the flood is they were forewarned by fallen angels that they were coming, and they either went into places in the earth, which is in some of the mythologies. They were taken in clouds in the air, as in some of the mythologies, or they survived on arks, as what the Epic of Gilgamesh or the Deucalion and Pyrrha mythology of the Greeks would suggest. And that's an interesting one to come back to in itself.
Yes.
And then the third way is they either were on the ark, or either the sons or the wife of Noah or the sons of Noah or the wives of Noah's sons somehow were Nephilim or carried Nephilim DNA so that they would start after the flood.
Yeah.
There's only three ways.
Yeah.
The ways that the Gnostics present for the most part in their religion is that a number of sort of, they're not always consistent, and there's so many Gnostic Bibles. They say that all of the people on the ark were giants, or Ham was a giant, or Ham and Japheth were giants. And there's several different variations on how they describe that. But they definitely go with somehow that giants were on the ark, and the Bible is inaccurate in that. And I find that one a little hard to believe. And I also find it hard to believe that there'd be DNA in the wives of the that married the daughters or the sons of Noah, because, you know, God seemingly went to a very strict application in terms of saying, I'm going to have Noah because he's pure and here's his genealogies, and therefore the sons are his genealogy. And they always married within that family bloodline. And so now to bring in daughters that would be outside the Sethite bloodline that they could document, that seems very odd to me.
Well, what view do you hold, Gary?
Well, depending on the day, but I tend to go with a survival and a recursion. So let me tell you why I think it could be both. Although I won't discount the third option because it's possible. What we do know is giants were after the flood and they were before the flood. And we do know God said in Genesis 6 that would be the case.
Yeah.
We're just not told how. And for those people say, well, but all the things and beings that God created were destroyed with the flood. I agree with that assessment, but I would also point out that God did not create the Nephilim. The fallen angels did.
Yeah.
So if the intent of the language was just to describe that that God had wiped out everything he created, that actually happened that way. And the idea that he knew that giants were going to be after the flood means he knew that was going to happen too. So it doesn't really matter how we get there.
Yeah.
Giants were after the flood somehow, some way. So if I look at the Epic of Gilgamesh, for example, and Gilgamesh is recorded in some Gnostic Gospels and coming out of Qumran, he was a giant in the antediluvian world, and he's one of the giants that are forewarned of the flood. And I find that an amazing coincidence.
It is.
But he's telling this story to Anakeddon. Now, Gilgamesh, described in the Epic of Gilgamesh, is two-thirds God and one-third human, and from before the flood. So he's a demigod, and he's a giant, and he's a nasty giant, and he's a military giant, and so the gods after the flood, they create Enkidu or Enkidu, depending on which translation you want to talk about, they create him to offset Gilgamesh because he's so powerful and so evil. And he's pillaging and plundering, just what the Nephilim did to corrupt the ancient world. But unfortunately, Enkidu becomes friends with Gilgamesh. And Enkidu is also created by the gods and a human female, and is also two-thirds god and one-third demigod. And if he's a match for Gilgamesh, he's an Anunnaki Nephilim as well. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's who he's telling the story to. And the story is being told about Utnapishtim or Zayazudra, depending on which translation, again, out of Mesopotamia that you're using. And he is the archetypical king and Nephilim and demigod. So just in the preamble to the Epic of Gilgamesh, we've got three giants being mentioned. And Utnapishtim takes all of his immediate family with him. So we presume then that Gilgamesh is an immediate family of Zayazudra Utnapishtim because he survives the flood. And all of them are giants as well. So in this story, we have one before the flood and one created after the flood. So that suggests two possible ways.
Yes.
And if I know secular education is like to go back to the Epic of Gilgamesh and say it's the same story, only the Hebrews, they distorted the story and copied it. This is just an older surviving story, as opposed to that they found in stone, as opposed to the record of the Hebrews.
Yes.
And the stories are similar at the macro level, but the devil are in the details, so to speak, in the details. They're telling two different stories. One is a giant survival, and the Bible is about human survival, Sethite survival.
Yes. That's
right? Two different stories.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And they do not come together after that. When you understand that they're two different accounts, you just dismiss the other one as being nonsense, right, in terms of being the same story.
Mm-hmm.
Could be a true account, could be a made-up account after the flood to document it. Now, if you go to the Greek one, and this one is really interesting because Deucalion and Pyrrha are the two survivors, right? And they are always said to be the Greek names for Noah and his wife. Well, that's not true. So Deucalion is actually the son of Prometheus. And in Greek mythology, Prometheus is either a son of a god, so he's a titan, Nephilim, or he is a god. Because there's two different characters there. But either or, it doesn't matter, Deucalion is Nephilim.
Right. That's right.
Right?
Yes.
And Pyrrha has many different names in Greek mythology and in Gnostic religions, and a variation of that is Nereia, which you'll see in some of the accounts in Greek mythology. And Nereia is a variation of Nama, who was the daughter of Lamech, who was one of the four ones that reincarnated or reestablished the seven sciences and partnered with the Nephilim to create the Nephilim and married giants. Mm. So again, this is not a story of human survival.
Right.
This is another story of giants surviving.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
You have two choices. It's either an actual account of giant survival, or they're mimicking the biblical story.
Yes. Yeah. One or the other. Well, I think, Gary, I am going to save a couple of topics for our next interview, and maybe I'm letting the cat out of the bag early for our listeners, but and when they get a copy of your book, they'll understand why I'm saying this, but we're definitely going to have a part two, and I'm thinking maybe even a part three. This is very interesting information, and it's a little hard to digest it all in one sitting. So, what I would like to do though before we conclude this conversation, Gary, is to kind of bring this into the present, and let's chat for a little bit about how Hollywood has advanced the mythologies of the world that are really biblical accounts of the Nephilim, in the stories, the movies that they produce, especially the superhero stories, people think that it's great entertainment, but really there's a lot more going on there than what people are aware of, isn't there?
There is, and if you look at what Hollywood does, whether or not it's a superhero, so understand that that is, again, keeping alive the mythos of what happened before the flood, as we talked about hero, is exactly what the Nephilim are described as, and they were demigods, created from the partnering of gods and human females. And everything that goes around the superheroes with extraordinary powers,
yes,
would be powers that they're trying to keep alive, about traits that they would have inherited from the demigods, or from the gods, right?
Yes.
And so, and or DNA enhancement, because again, they had the technology to change the DNA in the antediluvian world because of the sciences that they developed. And that's why you have things like the Chimera. You have, and mm-hmm, notice that lately, Chimera, they're taking,
yes,
off the rules to do that, to crossbreed animals. You have the Pegasus. You have Centaurs. You have so many. You have Cyclops. You have so many of these fantastic animals that were created in the antediluvian world. This is what this is all reflecting when you see these superheroes. But the main one is that there's heroes that were sent to us, and also wise ones who were sent to us, which is part of their belief system, and continue to do so. But Hollywood, whether it's, let me just sort of take another back step, whether or not it's Ovides in ancient Rome, or it's Greek mythology, or it's Shakespeare, or it's fairy tales, or it's modern literature, or it's Harry Potter, or it's Lord of the Rings, or it's science fiction, or it's Walt Disney, or it's these superhero movies, or it's horror movies, or it's Dracula movies, or you name the type of genre that they're talking about, this is all encoded history.
Yes.
Legacy and genealogies of what happened in the antediluvian world and afterwards. And it's designed to hide what they did, what they believe, what happened, what they're doing, what they intend to do in plain sight, because they think we are too stupid to understand and decode this.
Yes. That's absolutely right. Well, Gary's book is The Genesis 6 Conspiracy: How Secret Societies and the Descendants of Giants Plan to Enslave Humankind. Gary's website is Genesis6Conspiracy.com. Gary, any new projects you're working on that you want to share with our listeners?
I'm working on some projects for some documentaries and stuff, but nothing for a speaking engagement lined up, but again, working on a few things like that. I have not spent enough time on the new book that I'm working on, but that won't be out for a couple of years. Kind of goes in a little different direction. So basically still working on promoting this book and getting pretty good feedback in terms of what's in the book and that people want to hear more. Also wanted to interject a little bit about the Hollywood that I should have done before.
Yeah.
Instead of going on a tangent, is even the name Hollywood is occultic. I mean, holly, it's the wood to make magic wands.
I've never heard that before. That's a good one.
It is, and it's used in, you know, and it's also heavily connected to the ruler of winter and druidic mysteries, you know, that other people might know as Sol Invictus or the Yuletide festivals of Christmas. And you know, magic wands are used to put people under magic spells and control them, and that's what they're trying to do with the entertainment.
Yes.
Brainwash people.
Yes. Well, next time we get together and have a conversation, Gary will talk about secret societies in much more detail, especially the Freemasons. The Rosicrucians are involved in that, the infamous Illuminati. And we'll talk about the ideal of Atlantis and how that plan is still alive and well today among those that advocate for a new world order. We'll talk about the importance of Nimrod to Freemasonry. We want to talk about some of those antediluvian, the ancient knowledge such as pearls of wisdom, the golden apple, the hidden vaults of Enoch, which you touched on. But we've got a lot more to talk about and educate people on. So I'm really excited, looking forward to our next conversation. Gary, I appreciate you being on the program with me.
Well, thank you for having me. Hopefully we've piqued some curiosity and that people will tune in to hear about some of the things you were just mentioning, because I think a lot of this will be very eye-opening to people. So
yes,
hang in there with us and we'll explain it as we go.
Amen. Thank you, Gary. God bless you.
Thank you. God bless you, too. And thank you for having me again.
Thank you so much. Soaring Eagle Radio is a production of Transforming Word Ministries and is released under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. You may subscribe to the show on iTunes, follow us on Facebook where you can discuss this episode, and follow Soaring Eagle Radio on Twitter at Soaring Eagle Rad, and listen to every episode from our website, www.soaringeagleradio.com. The opening audio montage collection was created by Micah 68 Productions. Visit them on the internet at www.mika68.com for more information. Friends, remember the Apostle Paul's admonition to the believers meeting in Rome. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. Thank you for joining us today for this edition of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Thanks for tuning in today to the Soaring Eagle Radio program. For more information about the show, write us at Soaring Eagle Radio, 682 West Grand Avenue, Lima, Ohio, 45801. You may also contact Mike directly by email at